It's not his bridge. The monk's choice for prior has to be approved by the bishop. Richard could let it be known that he won't approve anyone who refuses to rebuild the bridge. Some monks might be defiant, but others will say there's no point in voting for someone who isn't going to be ratified. I see. You really think my father could help?
Absolutely.
Then I'll suggest it. Thank you. The bell rang. Godwin slipped out of the church and again joined the procession forming up in the cloisters. It was midday. He had done a good morning's work. Chapter 16. Wulfric and Gwenda left Kingsbridge early on Monday morning to walk the long road back to their village of Wigley. Carys and Merthyn watched them cross the river on Merthyn's new ferry. Merthyn was pleased by how well it was working. The wooden gears would wear out quite quickly, he knew. Iron gears would be better, but Carys had other thoughts.
Gwenda is so much in love, she sighed.
She has no chance with Wulfric, Merthyn said.
You never know.
She's a determined girl. Look how she escaped from Sim Chapman. But Wulfric's engaged to that Annet, who is much prettier. Good looks aren't everything in a romance, for which I thank God every day. She laughed.
I love your funny face.
But Wulfric fought my brother over Annet. He must love her.
Gwenda's got a love potion.
Merthyn gave her a disapproving look.
So you think it's all right for a girl to maneuver a man into marrying her when he loves someone else?
She was struck silent for a moment. The soft skin of her throat turned pink.
I never thought of it that way, she said. Is it really the same thing?
It's similar.
But she's not coercing him. She just wants to make him love her.
She should try to do that without a potion. Now I feel ashamed of helping her. Too late. Wulfric and Gwenda were getting off the ferry on the far side. They turned to wave, then headed along the road through the suburbs with Skip the dog at their heels. Merthyn and Carys walked back up the main street. Carys said,
You haven't spoken to Griselda yet. I'm going to do it now. I don't know whether I'm looking forward to it or dreading it.
You've got nothing to fear. She's the one who lied.
That's true.
He touched his face. The bruise had almost healed. I just hope her father doesn't get violent again.
Do you want me to come with you?
He would have been glad of her support, but he shook his head. I made this mess, and I have to straighten it out. They stopped outside Elfric's house. Carys said,
Good luck.
Thanks. Merthyn kissed her lips briefly, resisted the temptation to kiss her again, and walked in. Elfric was sitting at the table, eating bread and cheese. A cup of ale stood in front of him. Beyond him, Merthyn could see Alice and the maid in the kitchen. There was no sign of Griselda. Elfric said, Where have you been? Merthyn decided that if he had nothing to fear, he had better act fearlessly. He ignored Elfric's question. Where's Griselda?
Still in bed.
Merthyn shouted up the stairs. Griselda! I want to talk to you. Elfric said, No time for that. We've got work to do. Again, Merthyn ignored him.
Griselda! You'd better get up now.
Hey, Elfric said, Who do you think you are to give orders?
You want me to marry her, don't you?
So what?
So, she'd better get used to doing what her husband tells her. He raised his voice again.
Get down here now, or you'll just have to hear what I've got to say from someone else.
She appeared at the top of the stairs.
I'm coming, she said irritably. What's all the fuss about?
Merthyn waited for her to come down, then said, I found out who the father of the baby is. Fear flashed in her eyes.
Don't be stupid, it's you.
No, it's Thurston.
I never lay with Thurston.
She looked at her father.
Honestly, I didn't.
Elfric said,
She doesn't lie.
Alice came out of the kitchen.
That's right, she said.
Merthyn said, I lay with Griselda on the Sunday of Fleece Fair week.
15 days ago. Griselda is 3 months pregnant.
I'm not!
Merthyn looked hard at Alice.
You knew, didn't you?
Alice looked away. Merthyn went on, and yet you lied.
Even to Caris, your own sister.
Elfric said,
you don't know how long pregnant she is.
Look at her, Merthyn replied. You can see the bulge in her belly. Not much, but it's there.
What do you know of such things? You're just a boy.
Yes. You were all relying on my ignorance, weren't you? And it almost worked. Elfric wagged his finger.
You lay with Griselda, and know you'll marry Griselda.
Oh, no, I won't. She doesn't love me. She lay with me to get a father for her baby after Thurston ran away. I know I did wrong, but I'm not going to punish myself for the rest of my life by marrying her.
Elfric stood up.
You are, you know.
No.
You've got to.
No.
Elfric's face turned red, and he shouted,
you will marry her!
Merthyn said, how long do you want me to keep on saying no?
Elfric realized he was serious.
In that case, you're dismissed, he said. Get out of my house and never come back.
Merthyn had been expecting this, and it came as a relief. It meant the argument was over.
All right. He tried to step past Elfric. Elfric blocked his way.
Where do you think you're going?
To the kitchen, to get my things.
Your tools, you mean?
Yes.
They're not yours. I paid for them.
An apprentice is always given his tools at the end of his...
Merthyn tailed off.
You haven't finished your apprenticeship, so you don't get your tools.
Merthyn had not expected this.
I've done 6.5 years. You're supposed to do 7.
Without tools, Merthyn could not earn his living. That's unfair. I'll appeal to the Carpenter's Guild.
I look forward to it,
Elfric said smugly. It will be interesting to hear you argue that an apprentice who is sacked for lying with his master's daughter should be rewarded with a free set of tools. The carpenters in the guild have all got apprentices, and most of them have daughters.
They'll throw you out on your arse.
Merthyn realized he was right.
Alice said, there you are. You're in real trouble now, aren't you?
Yes, Merthyn said, but whatever happens, it won't be as bad as life with Griselda and her family. Later that morning, Merthyn went to St. Mark's Church for the funeral of Howell Tyler. He attended because he hoped someone there would give him a job. Howell had not died in the collapse of the bridge, but had fallen from the roof of St. Mark's. Looking up at the timber ceiling, the church did not have a stone vault. Merthyn could see a man-shaped hole in the painted wood, grim testament to the manner of Howell's death. Everything up there was rotten, the builders at the funeral said knowingly, but they said it after the accident, their sagacity coming too late to save Howell. It was now clear that the roof was too weak to be repaired, but must be demolished completely and rebuilt from scratch. That meant closing the church. St. Mark's was a poor church. It had a pitiful endowment, a single farm 10 miles away that was kept by the priest's brother and just about managed to feed the family. The priest, Father Geoffroy, had to get his income from the 800 or 900 citizens of his parish in the poorer north end of town. Those who were not actually destitute generally pretended to be, so their tithes brought in only a modest sum. He made his living by christening, marrying, and burying them, charging a lot less than the monks at the cathedral. His parishioners married early, had many children, and died young, so there was plenty of work for him, and in the end he did well enough. But if he closed the church, his income would dry up, and he would not be able to pay the builders. Consequently, the work on the roof had stopped. All the town's builders came to the funeral, including Elfric. Merthyn tried to look unashamed as he stood in the church, but it was difficult. Most of them knew he had been dismissed. He had been unjustly treated, but, unfortunately, he was not completely innocent.
Hal had had a young wife who was friendly with Caris, and now Caris walked in with the widow and the bereaved family. Merthyn moved next to Caris and told her what had happened with Elfric. Father Geoffroy conducted the service dressed in an old robe. Merthyn thought about the roof. It seemed to him there must be a way to dismantle it without closing the church. The standard approach, when repairs had been postponed too long and the timbers were too badly rotted to bear the weight of workmen, was to build scaffolding around the church and knock the timbers down into the nave. The building was then open to the elements until the new roof was finished and tiled. But it should be possible to build a swiveling hoist, supported by the thick side wall of the church, which would lift the roof timbers up one by one, instead of pushing them down, and swing them across the wall and down into the graveyard. That way, the wooden ceiling could be left intact and replaced only after the roof had been rebuilt. At the graveside, he looked at the men one by one, wondering which of them was most likely to employ him. He decided to approach Bill Watkin, the town's second-largest builder and no admirer of Elfric's. Bill had a bald dome with a fringe of black hair, a natural version of the monkish tonsure. He did most of the house building in Kingsbridge. Like Elfric, he employed a stonemason and a carpenter, a handful of labourers, and one or two apprentices. Howell had not been prosperous, and his body was lowered into the grave in a shroud, without a coffin. When Father Geoffroy had departed, Merthyn approached Bill Watkin. "Good day, Master Watkin," he said formally. Bill's response was not warm. "Well, young Merthyn?" "I've parted company with Elfric." "I know that," said Bill, "and I know why." "You've heard Elfric's side of the story."
"I've heard all I need to hear."
Elfric had been talking to people before and during the service, Merthyn realized. He was sure Elfric had left out, of his account, the fact that Griselda had tried to make Merthyn the substitute father for Thurston's baby. But he felt he would do himself no good by making excuses. Better to admit his fault. "I realize I did wrong, and I'm sorry, but I'm still a good carpenter." Bill nodded agreement.
"The new ferry testifies to that."
Merthyn was encouraged. "Will you hire me?"
"As what?"
"As a carpenter. You said I was a good one."
"But where are your tools?"
"Elfric wouldn't give them to me."
"And he was right, because you haven't finished your apprenticeship."
"Then take me on as an apprentice for 6 months,
and give you a new set of tools for nothing at the end of it."
"I can't afford that kind of generosity."
Tools were expensive because iron and steel were costly.
"I'll work as a labourer and save up to buy my own tools."
It would take a long time, but he was desperate.
"No."
"Why not?"
"Because I've got a daughter too." This was outrageous.
"I'm not a menace to maidens, you know."
"You're an example to apprentices. If you get away with this, what's to stop the others trying their luck?"
"That is so unjust."
Bill shrugged. "You might think so, but ask any other master carpenter in town. I think you'll find they feel as I do."
"But what am I to do?"
"I don't know. You should have thought of that before you shagged her."
"You don't care about losing a good carpenter?"
Bill shrugged again.
"All the more work for the rest of us."
Merthyn turned away. That was the trouble with guilds, he thought bitterly. It was in their interest to exclude people, for good or bad reasons. A shortage of carpenters would just drive up their wages. They had no incentive to be fair. Hal's widow left, accompanied by her mother. Caris, liberated from her duty of commiseration, came over to Merthyn.
"Why do you look unhappy?" she said. "You hardly knew Hal."
"I may have to leave Kingsbridge," he said. She went pale.
"Why on earth would you do that?"
He told her what Bill Watkin had said. "So you see, no one in Kingsbridge will hire me, and I can't work on my own account, for I've no tools. I could live with my parents, but I can't take the food from their mouths. So I'll have to seek work someplace where no one knows about Griselda. In time, perhaps I can save up enough money to buy a hammer and chisel, and then moved to another town and tried to gain admittance to the Carpenters' Guild. As he explained this to Caris, he began to appreciate the full misery of the situation. He saw her familiar features as if for the first time, and he was enchanted again by her sparkling green eyes, her small, neat nose, and the determined set of her jaw. Her mouth, he realized, did not quite fit the rest of her face. It was too wide and the lips were too full. It unbalanced the regularity of her physiognomy, the way her sensual nature subverted her tidy mind. It was a mouth made for sex, and the thought that he might have to go away and never kiss it again filled him with despair. Caris was furious.
This is iniquitous. They have no right.
That's what I think, but there seems to be nothing I can do about it. I just have to accept it. Wait a minute. Let's think about this. You can live with your parents and have your dinner at my house. I don't want to become a dependent like my father.
Nor should you.
You can buy Howell Tyler's tools. His widow was just telling me she's asking £1 for them. I haven't any money. Ask my father for a loan. He's always liked you. I'm sure he'll do it. But it's against the rules for anyone to employ a carpenter who isn't in the guild.
Rules can be broken. There must be someone in town desperate enough to defy the guild.
Merthyn realized he had allowed the old men to quench his spirit, and he was grateful for Caris for refusing to accept defeat. She was right, of course. He could stay in Kingsbridge and fight this unjust ruling. And he knew someone who was in desperate need of his talents. Father Geoffroy, he said.
Is he desperate? Why?
Merthyn explained about the roof. Let's go and see him, Caris said. The priest lived in a small house next to the church. They found him preparing a dinner of salt fish in a stew with spring greens. Geoffroy was in his 30s, built like a soldier, tall, with broad shoulders. His manner was brusque, but he had a reputation for sticking up for the poor. Merthyn said, I can repair your roof without closing your church. Geoffroy looked wary. You're an answer to prayer if you can. I'll build a hoist that will lift the roof timbers and deposit them in the graveyard. Alfric sacked you. The priest shot an embarrassed look in Caris's direction. She said, I know what happened, Father. Merthyn said, he dismissed me because I would not marry his daughter, but the child she is bearing is not mine. Geoffroy nodded. Some say you were treated unjustly. I can believe it. I have no great love for the guilds. Their decisions are rarely unselfish. All the same, you haven't completed your apprenticeship. Can any member of the Carpenters' Guild repair your roof without closing your church? I heard you haven't even got any tools. Leave that problem for me to solve. Geoffroy looked thoughtful. How much do you want to be paid? Merthyn stuck his neck out. 4 pence a day, plus the cost of materials.
That's a journeyman carpenter's wage.
If I don't have the skill of a qualified carpenter, you shouldn't hire me.
You're cocky.
I'm just saying what I can do.
Arrogance is not the worst sin in the world, and I can afford 4 pence a day, if I can keep my church open.
How long will it take you to build your hoist?
2 weeks at the most.
I'm not going to pay you until I can be sure it will work. Merthyn breathed in. He would be penniless, but he could cope with that. He could live with his parents and eat at Edmund Wooler's table. He would get by. Pay for the materials, and save my wages up until the first roof timber is removed and safely brought to ground. Geoffroy hesitated.
I'll be unpopular, but I have no choice.
He held out his hand. Merthyn shook it. Chapter 17. All the way from Kingsbridge to Wigley, a distance of 20 miles, a full day's walk, Gwenda was hoping for a chance to use the love potion, but she was disappointed. It was not that Wulfric was wary. On the contrary, he was open and friendly. He talked about his family, and told her how he wept every morning when he woke up, and realized their deaths were not a dream. He was considerate, asking whether she was tired and needed to rest. He told her that he felt land was a trust, something a man held for a lifetime, then passed to his heirs, and that when he improved his land, by weeding fields, fencing sheepfolds, or clearing stones from pasture, he was fulfilling his destiny. He even patted Skip. By the end of the day, she was more in love with him than ever. Unfortunately, he showed no sign of feeling anything for her more than a kind of camaraderie, caring but not passionate. In the forest with Sim Chapman, she had wished with all her heart that men were not so much like wild beasts, but now she wanted Wulfric to have a bit more of the beast in him. All day she did little things to arouse his interest. As if by accident, she let him see her legs, which were firm and shapely. When the terrain was hilly, she made it an excuse to take deep breaths and stick out her chest. At every opportunity she brushed against him, touched his arm, or put a hand on his shoulder. None of it had the least effect. She was not pretty, she knew, but there was something about her that often made men look hard at her and breathe through their mouths, but it was not working on Wulfric. They stopped for a rest at noon, and ate the bread and cheese they carried with them, but they drank water from a clear stream, using their hands as cups, and she had no opportunity to give him the potion. All the same, she was happy. She had him all to herself for a whole day. She could look at him, talk to him, make him laugh, sympathize with him, and occasionally touch him. She pretended to herself that she could kiss him any time she liked, but that at the moment she was not so disposed. It was almost like being married, and it was over too soon. They arrived in Wigley early in the evening. The village stood on a rise, its fields sloping away to all sides, and it was always windy. After 2 weeks in the bustle of Kingsbridge, the familiar place seemed small and quiet, just a scatter of rough dwellings along the road that led to the manor house and the church. The manor was as large as a Kingsbridge merchant's home, with bedrooms on an upper floor. The priest's house was also a fine dwelling, and a few of the peasant houses were substantial, but most of the homes were two-room hovels, one room normally being occupied by livestock, and the other serving as kitchen and bedroom for all the family. Only the church was built of stone. The first of the more substantial houses belonged to Wulfric's family. Its doors and shutters were closed, giving it a desolate look. He walked past it to the second big house, which was where Annet lived with her parents. He gave Gwenda a casual wave of farewell and went inside, smiling in anticipation. She felt the sharp tug of loss, as if she had just woken out of a delightful dream. She swallowed her discontent and set out across the fields. The early June rain had been good for the crops, and the wheat and barley were green, but now they needed sunshine to ripen them. Village women were moving along the rows of grain, bent double, pulling up weeds. Some waved to her. As she approached her home, Gwenda felt a mixture of apprehension and anger. She had not seen her parents since the day her father had sold her to Sim Chapman for a cow. Almost certainly, Pa thought she was still with Sim. Her appearance would come as a shock. What would he say when he saw her? And what was she going to say to the father who had betrayed her trust? She felt sure her mother knew nothing of the sale. Pa had probably told Ma some story about Gwenda running off with a boy. Ma was going to fly into a fearsome rage. She felt happy at the prospect of seeing the little ones, Kath, Joni, and Eric. She realized now how much she had missed them. On the far side of the 100-acre field, half hidden in the trees at the edge of the forest, was her home. It was even smaller than the peasants' hovels, having only one room, which was shared with the cow at night. It was made of wattle and daub, tree branches stuck upright in the ground, with twigs interwoven basket fashion, the gaps plugged with a sticky mixture of mud, straw, and cow dung. There was a hole in the thatched roof to let out the smoke of the fire in the middle of the earth floor. Such houses lasted only a few years, then had to be rebuilt. It now seemed meaner than ever to Gwenda. She was determined not to spend her life in such a place, having babies every year or two, most of whom died for lack of food. She would not live like her mother. She would rather die. When she was still 100 yards from the house, she saw her father coming towards her. He was carrying a jug, probably going to buy ale from Peggy Perkin, Annette's mother, who was the village brewster. Pa always had money at this time of year, for there was plenty of work to be had in the fields. At first, he did not see her. She studied his thin figure as he walked along the narrow gap between two field strips. He wore a long smock that came to his knees, a battered cap, and homemade sandals tied to his feet with straw. His gait managed to be both furtive and jaunty. He always looked like a nervous foreigner defiantly pretending to be at home. His eyes were set closely either side of a big nose, and he had a wide jaw with a knob of a chin, so that his face looked like a lumpy triangle. Gwenda knew that she resembled him in that. He glanced sidelong at the women he passed in the field, as if he did not want them to know he was observing them. As he came close, he threw her one of his sneaky looks, up from under his lowered eyelids. He looked down instantly, then looked up again. She lifted her chin and stared back at him haughtily. Astonishment spread across his face. "You," he said. "What happened?" "Sim Chapman wasn't a tinker. He was an outlaw. And where is he now?" "He's in hell, Tar. You'll meet him there." "Did you kill him?" "No." She had long ago decided to lie about this. "God killed him. The bridge at Kingsbridge collapsed while Sim was crossing it. God punished him for his sin. Has he punished you yet?" "God forgives good Christians." "Is that all you have to say to me? That God forgives good Christians?" "How did you escape?"
"I used my wits."
A crafty look came over his face.
"You're a good girl," he said.
She stared at him suspiciously.
"What mischief are you planning now?" "You're a good girl," he repeated. "Go into your mother now.
You shall have a cup of ale with your supper." He walked on. Gwenda frowned. Pa did not seem afraid of what Ma would say when she learned the truth. Perhaps he thought Gwenda would not tell her, out of shame. Well, he was wrong. Kath and Joni were outside the house playing in the dirt. When they saw Gwenda, they jumped up and ran to her. Skip barked hysterically. Gwenda hugged her sisters, remembering how she had thought she would never see them again, and at that moment she was fiercely glad she had stuck a long knife into Alwyn's head. She went inside. Ma was sitting on a stool, giving little Eric some milk, helping him hold the cup steady so that he did not spill any. She gave a cry of joy when she saw Gwenda. She put down the cup, stood up, and embraced her. Gwenda began to weep. Once she had started crying, it was hard to stop. She cried because Sim had led her out of town on a rope, and because she had let Alwyn fuck her, and for all the people who had died when the bridge collapsed, and because Wulfric loved Annette. When her sobs subsided enough for her to speak again, she said,
"Pa sold me, Ma. He sold me for a cow, and I had to go with outlaws."
"That was wrong," her mother said.
"It was worse than wrong. He's wicked, evil. He's a devil."
Ma withdrew from the embrace.
"Don't say such things." "They're true. He's your father. A father doesn't sell his children like livestock." "I have no father."
"He's fed you for 18 years.
Gwenda stared uncomprehendingly.
"How can you be so hard? He sold me to outlaws."
"And he got us a cow, so there's milk for Eric, even though my breasts have dried up. And you're here, aren't you?" Gwenda was shocked.
"You're defending him."
"He's all I've got, Gwenda.
He's not a prince. He's not even a peasant. He's a landless labourer. But he's done everything he can for this family for almost 25 years. He worked when he could, and thieved when he had to. He kept you alive, and your brother. And with a fair wind, he'll do the same for Kath and Joni and Eric. whatever his faults, we'd be worse off without him, so don't you call him a devil."
Gwenda was struck dumb. She had hardly got used to the idea that her father had betrayed her. Now she had to face the fact that her mother was as bad. She felt disoriented. It was like when the bridge had moved under her feet. She could hardly understand what was happening to her. Her father came into the house carrying the jug of ale. He seemed not to notice the atmosphere. He took 3 wooden cups from the shelf over the fireplace.
"Now then," he said cheerfully, "let's drink to the return of our big girl."
Gwenda was hungry and thirsty after walking all day. She took the cup and drank deeply. But she knew her father in this mood.
"What are you planning?" she said. "Well, now," he said, "it's the Shiring Fair next week, isn't it?" "So what?" "Well, we could do it again."
She could hardly believe what she was hearing.
"Do what again?" "I sell you. You go with the buyer. Then you escape and come home. You're none the worse." "None the worse? And we've got 12 shillings. Why, it takes me near half a year of labouring to earn 12 shillings. And after that? What then?" "Well, there's other fairs. Winchester, Gloucester, I don't know how many."
He refilled her cup from the ale jug.
"Why, this could be better than the year you stole Sir Gerald's purse."
She did not drink. There was a bitter taste in her mouth, as if she had eaten something corrupt. She thought of arguing with him. Harsh words came to her lips, angry accusations, curses. But she did not speak them. The way she felt was beyond rage. What was the point of having a row? She could never trust her father again. And because Ma refused to be disloyal to him, Gwenda could not trust her either.
"What am I to do?"
she said aloud, but she did not want an answer from anyone in the room. The question was to herself. In this family she had become a commodity, to be sold at city fairs. If she was not prepared to accept that, what could she do? She could leave. She realized with a shock that this house was no longer a home to her. The blow shook the foundations of her existence. She had lived here since before she could remember. Now she did not feel safe here. She had to get out. Not next week, she realized, not even tomorrow morning. She had to go now. She had nowhere to go, but that made no difference. To stay here and eat the bread her father put on the table would be to yield to his authority. She would be accepting his evaluation of her as a commodity to be sold. She was sorry she had drunk the first cup of ale. Her only chance was to reject him immediately and get out from under his roof. Gwenda looked at her mother.
"You're wrong," she said. "He is a devil. And the old stories are right. When you make a bargain with the devil, you end up paying more than you thought."
Ma looked away. Gwenda stood up. The refilled cup was still in her hand. She tipped it, pouring the ale on the floor. Skip immediately started to lick it up. Her father said angrily, "I paid a farthing for this jug of ale."
"Goodbye," said Gwenda, and she walked out.
Chapter 18. On the following Sunday, Gwenda attended the court hearing that would decide the fate of the man she loved. The manorial court was held in the church after the service. It was the forum in which the village took collective action. Some of the questions it addressed were disputes, arguments over field boundaries, accusations of theft or rape, quarrels about debts. But more often it made pragmatic decisions, such as when to begin ploughing with the communal 8-ox team. In theory, the lord of the manor sat in judgment over his serfs, but Norman law, brought to England by invaders from France almost 3 centuries earlier, compelled lords to follow the customs of their predecessors, and, in order to find out what those customs were, they had to formally consult 12 men of good standing in the village, a jury. So, in practice, the proceedings often became a negotiation between lord and villagers.
On this particular Sunday, Wagley had no lord. Sir Stephen had been killed in the collapse of the bridge. Gwenda had brought this news to the village. She also reported that Earl Rowland, who had the task of appointing Stephen's replacement, had been gravely injured. On the day before she left Kingsbridge, the Earl had recovered consciousness for the first time, but he had woken into a fever so violent that he was unable to speak a coherent sentence, so there was no prospect of a new Lord of Wigley yet. This was not an unusual circumstance. Lords were frequently away, at war, in Parliament, fighting lawsuits, or just attending on their Earl or the King. Earl Rowland always appointed a deputy, usually one of his sons, but in this case he had not been able to do so. In the absence of an overlord, the bailiff had to manage the landholding as best he could. The job of a bailiff or reeve was, in theory, to carry out the lord's decisions, but this inevitably gave him a degree of power over his fellows. Exactly how much power depended on the lord's personal preference. Some held tight control, others were lax. Sir Stephen had kept a loose rein, but Earl Rowland was notoriously strict. Nate Reeve had been bailiff to Sir Stephen and to Sir Henry before him, and would presumably be bailiff to whoever came next. He was a hunchback, a small, bent figure, thin and energetic. He was shrewd and greedy, careful to make the most of his limited power by demanding bribes from the villagers at every opportunity. Gwenda disliked Nate. It was not his greed she objected to. All bailiffs had that vice. But Nate was a man twisted by resentment as much as by his physical defect. His father had been bailiff to the Earl of Shiring, but Nate had not inherited that grand position, and he blamed his hump for the fact that he had ended up in the small village of Wigley. He seemed to hate all young, strong, handsome people. In his leisure hours he liked to drink wine with Perkin, Annette's father, who always paid for the liquor. The question before the court today was what to do about Wulfric's family's land. It was a large holding. Peasants were not all equal, and they did not have equal lands. The standard was a virgate, which was 30 acres in this part of England. In theory, a virgate was the area of land one man could farm, and normally yielded enough to feed one family. However, most Wigley peasants had a half-virgate, 15 acres, or thereabouts. They were obliged to find additional means of support for their families, netting birds in the woods, trapping fish in the stream that ran through Brookfield, making belts or sandals from cheap leather cut-offs, weaving cloth from yarn for Kingsbridge merchants, or poaching the king's deer in the forest. A few had more than a virgate. Perkin had 100 acres, and Wulfric's father Samuel had had 90. Such wealthy peasants needed help to farm their land, either from their sons and other relatives, or from hired labourers such as Gwenda's father. When a serf died, his land might be inherited by his widow, his sons, or a married daughter. In any event, the handover had to be licensed by the lord, and a stiff tax, called a heriot, was due. In normal circumstances, Samuel's land would automatically have been inherited by his two sons, and there would have been no need for a court hearing. They would have clubbed together to pay the heriot, then either divided up the land or farmed it together, and made some arrangement for their mother. But one of Samuel's sons had died with him, which complicated matters. Every adult in the village attended the court, in general. Gwenda had a particular interest today. Wulfric's future would be decided, and the fact that he planned to spend that future with another woman did not dampen Gwenda's concern. Perhaps she should have wished him a miserable life with Annette, she sometimes thought, but she could not. She wanted him to be happy. When the service was over, a large wooden chair and 2 benches were brought in from the manor house. Nate took the chair, and the jurymen sat on the benches. Everyone else stood. Wulfric spoke simply. "My father held 90 acres of the Lord of Wigley," he said. 50 acres were held by his father before him, and 40 by his uncle who died 10 years ago. As my mother is dead, and so is my brother, and I have no sisters, I am the sole heir."
"How old are you?" said Nate. 16 years. You can't even call yourself a man yet.
It seemed Nate was going to make things difficult. Gwenda knew why. He wanted a bribe, but Wulfric had no money.
Years aren't everything, Wulfric said. I'm taller and stronger than most grown men.
Aaron Appletree, one of the jurors, said, David Johns inherited from his father when he was 18.
Nate said, 18 isn't 16. I don't recall an instance where a 16-year-old was allowed to inherit.
David Johns was not a juror, and he was standing next to Gwenda.
I didn't have no 90 acres neither, he said,
and there was a ripple of laughter. David had a half-virgate, like most of them. Another juror spoke.
90 acres is too much for one man, let alone a boy. Why, it was farmed by 3 until now.
The speaker was Billy Howard, a man in his middle 20s who had wooed Annette unsuccessfully, which might be why he wanted to side with Nate in putting obstacles in Wulfric's way.
I've got 40 acres, and I have to hire labourers at harvest time.
Several of the men nodded agreement. Gwenda began to feel pessimistic. It was not going Wulfric's way.
I can get help, Wulfric said.
Nate said, have you got money to pay labourers? Wulfric looked a bit desperate, and Gwenda's heart went out to him. My father's purse was lost when the bridge collapsed, and I spent what money I had on the funeral, he said. But I can offer my labourers a share of the harvest. Nate shook his head.
Everyone in the village is already working full-time on their own lands, and those who have no land are already employed. And no one is likely to give up a job that pays cash for one that offers a share of an uncertain crop.
I will get the harvest in, Wulfric said with passionate determination. I can work day and night if I have to. I'll prove to you all that I can handle it.
There was so much yearning on his handsome face that Gwenda wanted to jump up and shout her support for him. But the men were shaking their heads. Everyone knew that one man could not harvest 90 acres on his own. Nate turned to Perkin.
He's engaged to your daughter. Can't you do something for him?
Perkin looked thoughtful.
Perhaps you should transfer the land to me for the time being. I could pay the Harriet. Then when he marries Annette, he could take over his land.
No,
Wulfric said immediately. Gwenda knew why he was so against the idea. Perkin was nothing if not sly. He would spend every waking minute between now and the wedding trying to figure out a way of keeping Wulfric's land for himself. Nate said to Wulfric,
if you have no money, how will you pay the Harriet?
I'll have money when I get the harvest in.
If you get the harvest in, and then it may not be enough. Your father paid £3 for his father's lands and £2 for his uncle's.
Gwenda gasped. £5 was a fortune. It seemed impossible that Wulfric could raise so much money. It would probably have taken all his family's savings. Nate went on,
besides, the Harriet is normally paid before the inheritor takes possession, not after the harvest.
Aaron Appletree said, in the circumstances, Nate, you might show leniency on that point.
Might I? A lord may show leniency, for he holds sway over his own possessions. But if a bailiff shows leniency, he's giving away someone else's gold.
But we will only be making a recommendation in any case. Nothing will be final until approved by the new Lord of Wigley, whoever he may be.
That was true, strictly speaking, Gwenda thought. But in practice it was unlikely a new lord would overturn an inheritance from father to son. Wulfric said,
sir, my father's Harriet was not so much as £5.
We must check the rolls.
Nate's response was so quick that Gwenda guessed he had been waiting for Wulfric to challenge the amount. Nate often engineered a pause of some kind in the middle of a hearing, she reflected. She presumed it was to give the parties an opportunity to offer him a bribe. Perhaps he thought Wulfric was concealing some money. Two jurors brought from the vestry the chest containing the manorial rolls, the record of the manor court's decisions, written on long strips of parchment rolled into cylinders. Nate could read and write,
A bailiff had to be literate in order to compile accounts for the lord. He searched through the box for the right one. Gwenda felt that Wulfric was doing badly. His plain speaking and evident honesty were not enough. Nate wanted above all else to make sure he collected the lord's heriot. Perkin was manoeuvring to get the land for himself. Billy Howard wanted to do Wulfric down out of sheer malice, and Wulfric had no money for a bribe. He was also guileless. He believed that if he stated his case, he would get justice. He had no sense of managing the situation. Perhaps she could help him. A child of Joby's could not grow up without learning something about guile. Wulfric had not appealed to the villager's self-interest in his arguments. She would do so for him. She turned to David Johns, standing beside her.
"I'm surprised you men aren't more worried about this," she said.
He gave her a shrewd look. "What are you getting at, lass?"
"Despite the sudden deaths, this is an inheritance from father to son. If you let Nate quibble about this one, he'll question them all. He can always dream up some reason for arguing about a legacy. Aren't you afraid he'll interfere with your own son's rights?"
David looked worried. "You might have a point there, girl," he said, and he turned to talk to his neighbour on the other side. Gwenda also felt it was a mistake for Wulfric to demand a final ruling today. Better to ask for a temporary judgment, which the jurymen would grant more readily. She went to speak to Wulfric. He was arguing with Perkin and Annette. When Gwenda appeared, Perkin looked suspicious, and Annette put her nose in the air, but Wulfric was as courteous as ever.
"Hello, my travelling companion," he said. "I heard you left your father's house. He threatened to sell me."
"A second time? As many times as I could escape. He thinks he's found a bottomless purse. Where are you living?"
"Widow Hubert's took me in, and I've been working for the bailiff on the lord's lands. A penny a day, sunrise to sunset. Nate likes his labourers to go home tired.
Do you think he'll give you what you want?"
Wulfric made a face. He seems reluctant.
"A woman would handle it so differently."
He looked surprised.
"How so?"
Annette glared at her, but Gwenda ignored the look.
"A woman would not demand a ruling, especially when everyone knows that today's decision isn't final. She would not risk a no for the chance of a maybe."
Wulfric looked thoughtful.
"What would she do?"
"She would just ask to be allowed to continue working the land for now. She would let the binding decision wait until the new lord is appointed. She would know that in the interim, everyone would get used to her being in possession, so that when the new lord showed up, his approval would seem like a formality. She would gain her objective without giving people much chance to argue about it." Wulfric was not sure.
"Well, it's not what you want, but it's the most you can get today. And how can Nate refuse you when he has no one else to bring in the harvest?"
Wulfric nodded. He was working out the possibilities. "People would see me reaping the crop and become accustomed to the idea. After that, it would seem unjust to deny me the inheritance, and I'd be able to pay the heriot, or some of it."
"You'd be a lot closer to your goal than you are now."
"Thank you."
"You're very wise."
He touched her arm, then turned back to Annette. She said something sharp to him in an undertone. Her father looked annoyed. Gwenda turned away.
"Don't tell me I'm wise," she thought. "Tell me I'm...
what? Beautiful?
Never.
The love of your life?
That's Annette.
A true friend? To hell with that.
So what do I want? Why am I desperate to help you?"
She had no answer. She noticed David Johns speaking emphatically to one of the jurors, Aaron Appletree. Nate flourished the manor roll.
"Wulfric's father, Samuel, paid 30 shillings to inherit from his father and £1 to inherit from his uncle."
A shilling was 12 pennies. There was no shilling coin, but everyone talked about shillings just the same. 20 shillings made £1. The sum Nate had announced was exactly half what he had originally said. David Johns spoke up.
"A man's lands should go to his son," he said. "We don't want to give our new lord, whoever he may be, the impression that he can pick and choose who shall inherit." There was a murmur of agreement. Wulfric stepped forward. "Bailiff, I know you can't make a final decision today, and I'm content to wait until the new lord is appointed. All I ask is that I should be allowed to continue to work the land. I will bring in the harvest, I swear it, but nothing is lost to you if I fail, and nothing is promised to me if I succeed. When the new lord comes, I will throw myself on his mercy." Nate looked cornered. Gwenda felt sure he had been hoping for some way of making money out of this. Perhaps he had expected a bribe from Perkin, Wulfric's prospective father-in-law. She watched Nate's face as he tried to think of a way to refuse Wulfric's more modest request. As he hesitated, one or two villagers began to mutter, and he realized he was doing himself no good by revealing his reluctance. "Very well," he said with a show of grace that was not very convincing. "What does the jury say?" Aaron Appletree conferred briefly with his fellow jurors, then said, "Wulfric's request is modest and reasonable. He should occupy the lands of his father until the new lord of Wigley is appointed." Gwenda sighed with relief. Nate said, "Thank you, jurymen." The court broke up, and people began to head home for dinner. Most of the villagers could afford to eat meat once a week, and Sunday was the usual day they chose. Even Joby and Ethna could generally manage a stew of squirrel or hedgehog, and at this time of year there were plenty of young rabbits to be caught. Widow Hubert's had a neck of mutton in a pot on the fire. Gwenda caught Wulfric's eye as they were leaving the church. "Well done," she said as they strolled out together. "He couldn't refuse you, though he seemed to want to." "It was your idea," he said admiringly. "You knew exactly what I needed to say. I don't know how to thank you." She resisted the temptation to tell him. They walked through the graveyard. She said, "How will you manage the harvest?" "I don't know." "Why don't you let me come and labor for you?" "I've no money." "I don't care. I'll work for food." He stopped at the gate, turned, and gave her a candid look. "No, Gwenda, I don't think that would be a good plan. Annette wouldn't like it, and, to be frank, she'd be right." Gwenda found herself blushing. There was no doubt what he meant. If he had wanted to reject her because she might be too weak or something, there would have been no need for the direct look, nor for the mention of his fiancée's name. He knew, she realized with mortification, that she was in love with him, and he was refusing her offer of help because he did not want to encourage her hopeless passion. "All right," she whispered, looking down. "Whatever you say." He smiled warmly. "But thank you for the offer." She made no reply, and, after a moment, he turned and walked away. Chapter 19 Gwenda got up while it was still dark. She slept in the straw on the floor of Widow Hubert's house. Somehow her sleeping mind knew the time and woke her just before dawn. The widow, lying next to her, did not stir when Gwenda unwrapped her blanket and stood up. Finding her way by touch, she opened the back door and stepped into the yard. Skip followed her, shaking himself. She stood still for a moment. There was a fresh breeze, as always in Wigley. The night was not totally black, and she could make out vague shapes, the duck house, the privy, the pear tree. She could not see the neighboring house, which was Wulfric's, but she heard a low growl from his dog, tethered outside the small sheepfold, and she murmured a quiet phrase so that it would recognize her voice and be reassured. It was a peaceful time, but nowadays there were too many such moments in her day. All her life she had lived in a tiny house full of babies and children, and at any instant at least one of them was clamoring for food, crying because of a minor hurt, shouting a protest, or screaming with helpless, infantile rage. She would never have guessed she might miss that. But she did, living with the quiet widow, who chatted amiably enough but was equally comfortable with silence. Sometimes Gwenda longed to hear a child cry, just so that she could pick it up and comfort it.
She found the old wooden bucket and washed her hands and face, then went back inside. She located the table in the dark, opened the bread box, and cut a thick slice from the weak old loaf. Then she set out, eating the bread as she walked. The village was silent. She was the first up. Peasants worked from sunup to sundown, and at this time of year it was a long, weary day. They treasured every moment of rest. Only Gwenda also used the hour between dawn and sunrise, and the hour of twilight at the end of the day. Dawn broke as she left the houses behind and set out across the fields. Wigley had three great fields, Hundred Acre, Brookfield, and Longfield. Different crops were grown on each in a three-year cycle. Wheat and rye, the most valuable grains, were sown in the first year. Then lesser crops, such as oats, barley, peas, and beans in the second year, and in the third year the field was left fallow. This year, Hundred Acre was in wheat and rye, Brookfield in various secondary crops, and Longfield was fallow. Each field was divided into strips of about 1 acre, and each serf's land consisted of a number of strips scattered across all three fields. Gwenda went to Hundred Acre and began weeding one of Wolfric's strips, pulling up the persistent new growth of dockweed, marigolds, and dog fennel from between his stalks of wheat. She was happy working on his land, helping him, whether he knew about it or not. Every time she bent down, she was saving his back the same effort. Every time she pulled a weed, she made his crop greater. It was like giving him presents. As she worked, she thought of him, picturing his face when he laughed, hearing his voice. The deep voice of a man, yet with the eagerness of a boy. She touched the green shoots of his wheat and imagined she was stroking his hair. She weeded until sunrise, then moved to the domain lands, those strips farmed by the lord or his laborers, and worked for pay. Although Sir Stephen was dead, his crop still had to be reaped, and his successor would demand a strict account of what had been done with the proceeds. At sundown, having earned her daily bread, Gwenda would move to another part of Wulfric's holding and work there until dark, longer if there was a moon. She had said nothing to Wulfric, but in a village of only 200 people, few things remained secret for long. Widow Huberts had asked her with gentle curiosity what she hoped to achieve.
"He's going to marry Perkins' girl, you know. You can't prevent that."
"I just want him to succeed," Gwenda had replied. "He deserves it. He's an honest man with a good heart, and he's willing to work until he drops. I want him to be happy, even if he does marry that bitch."
Today the domain workers were in Brookfield, harvesting the lord's early peas and beans, and Wulfric was nearby, digging a drainage ditch. The land was swampy after the heavy rain of early June. Gwenda watched him working, wearing only his drawers and boots, his broad back bending over the spade. He moved as tirelessly as a mill wheel. Only the sweat glistening on his skin betrayed the effort he was making. At midday, Annette came to him, looking pretty, with a green ribbon in her hair, carrying a jug of ale and some bread and cheese wrapped in a piece of sacking. Nate Reeve rang a bell, and everyone stopped work and retreated to the fringe of trees at the north end of the field. Nate gave out cider, bread, and onions to the domain workers. Dinner was included in their remuneration. Gwenda sat with her back against a hornbeam tree and studied Wulfric and Annette with the fascination of a condemned man watching the carpenter build the gallows. At first, Annette was her usual flirtatious self, tilting her head, batting her eyelids, playfully striking Wulfric in mock punishment for something he said. Then she became serious, speaking to him insistently while he seemed to protest innocence. They both looked at Gwenda, and she guessed they were talking about her. She presumed Annette had found out about her working on Wulfric's strips in the mornings and evenings. Eventually, Annette left, looking petulant, and Wulfric finished his dinner in thoughtful solitude. After eating, everyone rested for the remainder of the dinner hour. The older people lay full length on the ground and dozed, while the youngsters chatted. Wulfric came to where Gwenda sat and crouched beside her.
"You've been weeding my strips," he said. Gwenda was not going to apologize. "I suppose Annette scolded you. She doesn't want you working for me. What would she like me to do? Put the weeds back in the earth?" He glanced around and lowered his voice, not wanting others to hear, although everyone could surely guess what he and Gwenda were saying to one another. "I know you mean well, and I'm grateful, but it's causing trouble." She enjoyed being this close to him. He smelled of earth and sweat. "You need help," she said, "and Annette isn't much use. Please don't criticize her. In fact, don't speak of her at all." "All right, but you can't get the harvest in alone." He sighed. "If only the sun would shine." Automatically he looked up at the sky, a peasant reflex. There was thick cloud from horizon to horizon. All the grain crops were struggling in the cool, damp weather. "Let me work for you," Gwenda begged. "Tell Annette you need me." A man is supposed to be master of his wife, not the other way around. "I'll think about it," he said. But the next day he hired a laborer. He was a traveling man who showed up at the end of the afternoon. The villagers gathered around him in the twilight to hear his story. His name was Graham, and he came from Salisbury. He said his wife and children had been killed when his house burned down. He was on his way to Kingsbridge, where he hoped to get employment, perhaps at the Priory. His brother was a monk there. Gwenda said, "I probably know him. My brother, Philemon, has worked at the Priory for years. What's your brother's name?" "John." There were two monks called John, but before Gwenda could ask which was Graham's brother, he went on, "When I started out, I had a little money to buy food along the way. Then I was robbed by outlaws, and now I'm penniless." There was a lot of sympathy for the man. Wulfric invited him to sleep at his house. The next day, Saturday, he started to work for Wulfric, accepting board and lodging and a share of the harvest as his remuneration. Graham worked hard all day Saturday. Wulfric was shallow ploughing his fallow land in Longfield to destroy thistles. It was a two-man job. Graham led the horse, whipping it on when it flagged, while Wulfric guided the plough. On Sunday they rested. In church on Sunday, Gwenda burst into tears when she saw Calf, Joni, and Eric. She had not realized how badly she missed them. She held Eric through the service. Afterwards, her mother spoke harshly to her. "You're breaking your heart for that Wulfric. Weeding his strips won't make him love you. He's cross-eyed for that worthless Annette." "I know," Gwenda said, "but I want to help him anyway. You should leave the village. There's nothing for you here." She knew her mother was right. "I will," she said. "I'll leave the day after their wedding." Ma lowered her voice. "If you must stay, watch out for your father. He hasn't given up hope of another 12 shillings. "What do you mean?" Gwenda asked. Ma just shook her head. "He can't sell me now," Gwenda said. "I've left his house. He doesn't feed or shelter me. I work for the Lord of Wigley. I'm not pars to dispose of any longer." "Just watch out," said Ma, and she would say no more. Outside the church, the travelling man, Graham, talked to Gwenda, asking her questions about herself, and suggested they take a stroll together after dinner. She guessed what he meant by a stroll, and turned him down flat, but later she saw him with yellow-haired Joanna, the daughter of David Johns, who was only 15 and stupid enough to fall for the blandishments of a travelling man. On Monday, Gwenda was weeding Wulfric's wheat on 100 Acre in the half-light before sunrise, when Wulfric came across the field towards her at a run. His face was grim with fury. She had continued to defy his wishes, working on his lands every morning and evening, and it looked as if she had driven him too far. What would he do? Beat her up? After the way she had provoked him, he could probably do violence to her with impunity. People would say she had asked for it, and she had no one to stick up for her now that she had left her parents' home. She felt scared. She had seen Wulfric break Ralph Fitzgerald's nose. Then she told herself not to be foolish. Although he had been in many fights, she had never known him to strike a woman or a child. All the same, his anger made her tremble. But it was nothing like that. As soon as he got within hailing distance, he shouted, "Have you seen Graham?"
"No. Why?"
He came closer and stopped, breathing hard.
"How long have you been here?"
"I got up before dawn."
Wolfric's shoulders slumped.
"Then, if he came this way, he's out of reach by now.
What's happened?"
"He's disappeared. And so has my horse."
That explained Wolfric's rage. A horse was a valuable asset.